At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 112 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing search for the answer to the question, what is the thing about golf? Rod Morrie's my name, and in the giant machine that is golf, we often forget the importance of some of the smaller cogs. We fawn at the likes of Adam Scott and Min Ji Lee, and rightly so. But in a different way, the work done by every PGA professional is arguably at least as, if not more important, than the game's biggest stars. Many listeners will be familiar with the name Droop in professional golf circles, but the question is, which one? Do you remember Evan, today's guest from the Australian Tour of the 1990s? Or perhaps you've seen his son Fraser bob up on leaderboards in more recent years? Older listeners might remember Evan's father, Philip, who was the head professional at the Yarrawonga and Border Golf Club for more than three decades, a position Evan himself has held the past 18 years, and where he now oversees the traineeship of younger son, Baxter. Dynasties like this aren't unheard of in golf, but they do seem less common in the modern era. The Droops, though, are the real deal. I caught up with Evan recently at the Yarrawonga and Border Golf Club, who were kind enough to lend us a room for this chat. From the rapidly changing business of golf on the front lines to tales from the tour, it's a wander through a life lived fully in golf, and that always makes for interesting discussion. Well, Evan Droop, the first thing we do, as always, is say thank you for doing the thing about golf. We know it's a bit of a commitment, particularly for a bloke who runs a pro shop at a 45-hole facility, so not easy to find time in the day, and we do appreciate that.
No worries at all.
I'm going to start where I do with everybody while I think about which part of your career I want to start talking about. So while you're answering, I'll be thinking. And that is, the name is in the title, what's the thing about golf for Evan Droop?
Well, that's an interesting one, Rod. I think that I was born into the game. My father was a golf pro, and he came up here in 1969 to be the head professional at this golf club.
Yarrawonga Mulwala Golf Resort, we're talking about, or is it a golf club?
Yarrawonga Mulwala Golf Club Resort, is what it is now.
On the border of Victoria and New South Wales, very correct. Popular tourist destination area. We'll come to all that.
Yeah, that's right. So he came here in 1969 with my mother to become the head golf professional, and I was born in 1970. So effectively born and bred, I'm a local person. There's not many local people here apart from the ones that were born here. Mm-hmm. So my father's not a local, but I am.
And that would never have changed no matter how long you spent here, would it? If you weren't born here, you can never be a local, can you? It's one of those things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So 40 years in, you're still not a local.
Yeah, spot on. So I'm a local person. And I suppose being born and bred here, I just spent, my youth here, and I've been here all my life, really.
Yeah. So, except, yeah, of course, and you've partly answered my own question for you. I'm going to start with your tour career. Except, of course, when you went on the tour, the PGA Tour of Australasia. So you were a player.
Well, yeah, look, I did my traineeship here, mm-hmm. And then I decided to go out on the tour, and I was out there for about 5 years, a mm-hmm. little bit of mixed success. And, look, even when I was out on tour, the tour was, such that it had a sort of forward half and a back half to the year. And, in the middle of the year, I was sort of still based
sort of
here.
Back here.
Yeah, back here.
I feel like it's something that almost every trainee should do, is have a crack at the tour, because I think it shows you a side of golf that you might not get as an elite amateur and then as a trainee. Would you agree with that, do you think? Do you learn things about the game that are then important for what you do now, which is run the pro shop here?
Absolutely. Look, I think that if ever you're going to have aspirations to be a head golf professional or work at a facility, absolutely the traineeship is the way to go. Mm. I believe. I mean, I did it because I thought to myself, well, how long will I be out there for? And then if I'm super successful, well, I'd be still playing. Or if I can't cut the mustard, so to speak, I've got something to fall back on.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. You mentioned your dad was the head pro here. You're now the head pro here. Your two sons now here. Well, no, Fraser I don't think is here anymore. he's gone to the Gold Coast. You've got Baxter, I think, has started here.
Yes, now, yes.
What I'm getting at is dynasty didn't used to be that unusual in golf. Not common, but not that unusual. I think that you'd be almost among the only family that have got a bit of a dynasty going at the moment, wouldn't you, in terms of a golf club?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but it's certainly pretty unique. Yeah, so my dad was here in 1969, and it's been in the family ever since.
When did you take over from him?
So about 18 years ago.
Okay, so he did a good 30-odd years.
Yes, he did. And then I've been here, you know, back here in my current position for, you know, about 18 years. And then two sons, Fraser, who did his traineeship, and now I've got Baxter, who's in his just starting his third year with me as a trainer here at this golf club.
So Fraser, of course, played the tour. A lot of people hear the name Droop Australian Tour and they'll think of Fraser because his name's been appearing on leaderboards the last
few years. Yeah, well, he was a very good trainee, and then effectively COVID probably got the better of Fraser because he
it was bad timing.
Yeah, it was bad timing. So he finished his traineeship in 2019.
Wow.
End of 2019, and then by June 2021
it was all over.
We were still in lockdown here on the border. We had police on both sides of the bridge. It was a very, very tough time for us here, being on the border with, you know, with the state restrictions. And he decided he'd had enough, so he packed up his car and went to Queensland where he thought it would be better. And, thank God it has been good for him.
Still up there.
Yeah.
Difficult time for you there because, of course, we're closer to Melbourne here than we are to Sydney, and lots of your clientele come from Melbourne, don't you? And when that lockdown situation was in place in Victoria, had different rules to New South Wales, you're on the New South Wales side of the border, or your customers are on the Victorian side of the border. That must have been extraordinarily frustrating.
Yeah, look, it was bizarre. That's the only word I can probably think of to describe it. It was golf was classed as exercise in New South Wales. Mm-hmm. So effectively we could be open, and it wasn't classed as exercise in Victoria, and 90% of our members live on the Victorian side of the border. So
it's literally a 5-minute drive. It's not as hard to
2 minutes.
That's exactly right.
So effectively what would happen was somebody could drive from the middle of New South Wales and roll in here with no problems at all, and you would have no idea.
Drive 5 hours from Sydney if they wanted to.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely, or even north of Sydney. And they would roll in and there'd be no questions asked. And yet our member who lives 2 minutes on the other side of the river, and you know what they do, they're creatures of habit, they weren't allowed here. So it was really, really bizarre.
Yeah, indeed. What, if anything, can prepare you for that, Evan? That's a real hand grenade thrown into what's a pretty routine business, really, golf. As you know, a lot of your members will play at the same time with the same group each week. For your business, that's fantastic. You know before you start each week what's sort of going to happen. That's a real hand grenade to be thrown into a business that runs on such routine. How did you deal with that?
Well, it was quite amazing, really. I mean, at the start, we shut down for 12 weeks. Simply because, you know, all of our clientele basically, you know, as far as members go, came from Victoria. So workers weren't allowed over. So we actually shut the doors. So for the first 12 weeks, we shut the doors. And it was funny. I had nothing to do really. So I kept coming to work each day because I live in New South Wales. I live on the, you know, New South Wales side of the border. So I actually moved into the golf club.
Right.
And I became like a bit of a caretaker. I lived in the accommodation here.
It's a big house to have.
It's a huge house.
quite the yard too, 45 holes of golf.
With a massive backyard. Yes. Yeah, so
you
actually
didn't have
moved
to mow
on
it, did you?
No. So we you know, the place was barricaded up, you know, from the, you know, had the gate shut, and I moved here. So it was quite surreal.
That is surreal, isn't it? Yeah. It's truly bizarre. And even now you must think back and you can't put yourself back there, I don't think.
No.
Because it makes no sense.
No, and it didn't make any sense. And that was the whole thing about it was that we live, you know, our town is on the border, and we had two sets of rules, which were different from one another.
Always the case with border towns. If you go to north to Queensland, you'll find Tweed Heads has daylight savings and Kira on the other side does not.
Correct.
Wherever you draw a line, whether it be a speed limit or a state border, you're always going to get some of those fuzzy situations, but that must have been a really extreme example of it. I want to go back a bit. You said you started with your daddy, or you were sort of born into golf. What kind of age were you before you realised that golf would be your life? And did you have any brothers and sisters who didn't go into golf?
Look, I've got two sisters, and they're both a little bit younger than me. One of them was a golfer, or she is a bit of a golfer. And she played pennant at Yarra Yarra in Melbourne. Mum was a golfer, so she won the club championship here, I think, 13 times.
Wow.
She's won it. And so, yeah.
Tough act to follow.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Nana's the best golfer, the most accomplished golfer in the family. That's nice.
Yeah, that's right. And I've got two sisters and you know, one was a golfer. But effectively, golf is just a massive part of, you know, our family unit. And I've got another sister that doesn't play golf at all. So she lives up in Brisbane. She's a photographer.
Right.
And she's up there.
That's somewhat on your – golf's a funny game, isn't it? Is it different when you grow up within – you basically grow up within the business of golf? For most of us who come to golf, it's about the playing. The first discovery of golf is you hit a ball. Oh, that's a bit of fun and a bit of sport. Very different for you. That could turn people off, I'd imagine. Hasn't done you or your own sons, clearly. But perhaps one of your sisters felt that way?
Well, maybe she did. Yeah, maybe she did. She played other sports. So growing up in a, you know, a small country town, basically everyone played sport. So sport is very, very strong. And whether it be, you know, Aussie rules football here or cricket or tennis or swimming, you know, there's, you know, on the Murray River, so there's lots of water sports too, water skiing.
Did you try all of those?
All those. Yeah. So all those. So tried everything and I was probably, you know, I was just better at golf. Mm. So golf is the sport that I ended up being better at. So therefore I went down that line.
Yeah. And was it the competition that appealed to you? Or, I mean, I'm guessing you still teach other people today. You still play, I would imagine, a fair bit with this as your backyard. What's your relationship with the game itself?
So I haven't played a lot of recent times, but effectively, yeah, look, I just find it a challenge. I always found golf to be a challenge. I like that. And I think that's what, you know, a lot of people like about the game is it is a challenge. It's not an easy game. I mean,
ironically, it's the same thing that some people hate about the game.
That's exactly right. But it drives them. I think it drives them to try and be better
or give it up completely. One or it's correct, one or the other, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I noticed when I walked in, I said to you as we were coming across to the clubhouse here from the pro shop, old school. I was just chatting to your wife in the pro shop, and your son was behind the counter. That's a real. There's a feel about that. That's an old retail idea in some ways, isn't it? I don't think you'd I'm fascinated by it because I don't think you'd stumble into that in a lot of places. Lots of golf pro shops have been taken over by clubs, which I think most people would agree has not been to the betterment of the game. When the professional is not incentivized by their own business, perhaps they don't drive it the same way. You're not one of those clubs. You are in business, you and the family. And it seems to be where the place is packed today, Evan. The clubhouse is enormous. It's full of people. The pro shop is full of stock. It's walking off the shelves. You've got a 1980s golf business here. How are you doing it? There'll be pros out there who would love to know.
Yeah, well, look, I think that we certainly work hard at it. And it certainly is a, you know, it's a family-run business. But I think, you know, I have plenty of staff. And I think for me, it's about the team. That we put together. My wife is very much part of that team, and she just does a, you know, wonderful job probably organising me and the son that is working up there, Baxter, organises us and then organises the staff as well. So I think and I think that female element, we do have ladies working in the pro shop all the time, and I think, you know, they are born organisers at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, look, we work hard. We have plenty of staff. But I think the more staff I have on, the better we actually run. So we don't.
So you get a return on the investment.
Well, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of pro shops now that I see that you got one in the morning, and then that person goes home at lunchtime. You got one in the afternoon. It's very, very difficult to service people properly. You know, members and you know guests. So for a busy environment like this, it's
a simplistic way to run a business, isn't it? Because it's the easiest and obvious thing to do is to cut costs. And the easiest and most obvious way to cut costs is to cut people. But I don't think enough of or any of us in business think about what the cost of cutting people actually is to the business, because there is a price to pay, isn't there?
Absolutely. So I think with us, I pride ourselves on giving great customer service. And at the end of the day, the more staff I have on, then we can service people so that when they walk through the door, we can greet them, we can talk to them, and we can help them.
You can sell them something.
Absolutely.
Ultimately, what you're here to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because
it is, you know, at the end of the day, it becomes a really good environment to be in, and everyone's happy, and they're being looked after, and
they want to buy, you want to sell.
Absolutely.
What could be better than that? It's kind of that old school idea, isn't it? You're in business, and it can be easy when you're in the business of golf, and many of us get into the business of golf in whatever way because we love the golf first. That can be a trap, can't it? It's still a business, isn't it? You've got to run it. It's just golf is the product.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Yeah, totally agree. It is a business first and foremost, but look, for us, we try to make that business fun, and we try to make it, you know, a great environment to work in, and also for the client to come into. So,
yes, there's nothing worse than walking into an unhappy pro shop or an unhappy retail shop, is it? You rarely buy in those environments. You can pick up on vibes, can't you?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah,
totally agree.
It strikes me, Evan, that every year, sadly, a bunch of Australian golf pros fall off the perch, and they take with them some extraordinary knowledge about the business and the game. And those people tend to be people like you, who've spent their life in this environment, surrounded by people who play golf because they love it, be they scratch markers or 27 markers. That's a different kind of thing. How do we harness that? You must know blokes who've passed in the last 2-5 years who knew more about the game than you could hope to learn if you started now. Do you know what I mean? And I wonder whether the model you've got going, that's being passed down, not only to your own sons, but to others who come through the shop. And I wanted to talk to you about some of that also in a minute. I don't think that other system produces that. And golf pays a price for that, do you think? You've been in the business a long time. What are the changes you've seen?
I think it does. I think it does. But, look, I've got a couple of golf pros working here, very much part of, you know, our team that have been at other golf clubs. So I'm always on the lookout for good experienced golf pros that may move into the town or live fairly close by, and I try to keep them involved and active.
What creative ways do you have to do that? It's not just as simple as saying, you know, come work in the shop and give lessons, I'd imagine. There's got to be – or is it that simple?
Well, I think it just about is that simple. So, you know, I try to sit down and work out what they like and then try to, you know, put them in areas where they can, you know, where they're happy in the business. Like I've got a guy up there that's not a golf pro that's been a former manager, and he's fantastic at timesheets and running the computer, and you know, he's been a GM at Lang Lang Golf Club.
Right, okay.
And look, he's just unbelievable, but he's also very, very happy. And then I've got, you know, another couple of golf pros, and, you know, they're not forced to work 60 and 70 hours a week, but they can come in and they can do their 4 days, and they're happy, and they go home, and they're not taking all the baggage with them.
Yeah.
And they're happy in that environment.
Some people are born to be generals and some are born to be lieutenants, aren't they?
I think. Correct, yeah.
And if you put either in the opposite role, you tend to have a conflict there that doesn't lead to success.
Yeah.
If you hand the lieutenants all the generals' keys, you tend to get
– That's exactly sort of right. Trouble. Yeah. Yep.
You have been around the game a long time. What's your take on golf at the moment? It's in a funny sort of a place, isn't it? Prior to COVID, and I know it wasn't the case here because Rochelle told me that you weren't sort of feeling the effects that a lot of clubs were over that 2000 to 2020 period where the game was sort of in a slide. But what's your sort of take on where golf was before COVID, where we are in this sort of post-COVID era, how much COVID has had to do with that? What's the state of the golf industry, do you reckon?
I think right now it's in a pretty solid spot for here, and I'm talking about Yarrawonga. So when we got opened back up and a lot of other sports weren't able to be played, golf really took off here.
People came back to the game, didn't they? People who'd played previously, perhaps given it away for whatever reason, and now it's the only alternative, and they came back and perhaps rediscovered a love for the game.
Yeah, so we had that type of person, but we also had groups of ladies in their, you know, early to mid-50s that really hadn't played golf before take the game up here.
Okay.
And we tried to, you know, get a hold of them, harness them, and we've got this new breed of lady golfer. It's been fantastic for our club.
Has that changed the attitude or the way the club operates? Have you noticed a difference in the club since? They do tend to be still very male-heavy environments, golf clubs.
Yeah, this club has changed, certainly has changed this club. So we have got we've got a few ladies on the board now, and the ladies do an unbelievable job here at this golf club with what they do. They're a very, very solid group of, you know, members that we do have, but certainly our ladies section is fantastic here.
Do you sense that's a broader shift in the game? We haven't been particularly women-friendly, well, not as women-friendly as we could be as an industry and a sport, if you want to call it that. Do you sense that's broader than just here that change is happening?
Yeah, I think it's definitely changing.
If you had a daughter, would you advise her to go into the golf business? If she asked you?
If she asked me.
And would you have 40 years ago?
And I have got a daughter, and she's not in the golf business. But
maybe you've answered my question.
But if she wanted to go into golf business, I would, I would encourage it.
Would you have 40 years ago?
Probably not. Probably not. No, I think that the way a lot of clubs are operating now, you know, with the competitions and, you know, ladies allowed to play on Saturdays now, and then
– which was always madness, wasn't it, Evan? I mean, in hindsight, it makes no sense at all to exclude basically half of the population from taking part in your industry, sport,
yeah,
recreation.
Right.
It just makes no sense, does it? You can't make a compelling case for it. You can't make any case for it.
No, you're right. Spot on.
And, of course, the hangover of that has been we've created an uncomfortable environment for many women who now haven't been prepared to try the game because of those previous barriers. It's going to take some time before you'll have something approaching parity.
Yeah, correct. I think we're well on the way.
Mm.
Certainly a club like this is, you know, we're doing, we're running programs and you know, bits and pieces where we're trying to include, and we're going to continue to do that. We're going to continue to forge in that area.
Does business dictate that, or is it just the right thing to do, or is it a combination of both?
Combination of both.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely a combination of both, I believe.
Yeah. What sorts of feedback do you get? You said you've had quite the influx of women. The numbers have grown quite a lot in the post-COVID. What sort of feedback do you get from them?
Look, a lot of them are from here anyway, so they probably haven't been to another club. They just really like the way they're treated here, and they feel part of it. Especially within the within a ladies group and on a Wednesday, which is their main day. And they travel around, they do lots of different things, and the feedback is really, really positive.
Because, of course, long before you get to whether golf courses are good or bad, you like this golf course, you don't like that golf course, you got this. Those things you've just talked about are far more important, aren't they? And I wonder whether sometimes, and I know I'm guilty of this, because I'm already in golf and speak the language and do all those things, I jump straight to those things as being the important things. That's perhaps how we miss some of the simple stuff, like just being nice to people when they arrive and explaining where the pro shop is and how to get to the first tee. We tend to forget some of that, don't we, in the excitement of getting to the fourth hole, which our mate told us was a great golf hole.
Mm. No, you're right. You're right.
It can be kind of insular. I want to go to the tour. You played the tour at a time when I think a lot of our demographic who listen to this podcast would have been watching the golf. It was a very different thing in the 80s and 90s, professional tour of golf in Australia, to what it is now. Sadly, I don't think it's better now. I don't think anybody would. Talk to me a little bit about that time. Who were the kind of big name players and some of the experiences you had playing the Australian Tour in those days that your own son/sons probably won't get the opportunity in many ways that you did just because of the lack of tournaments themselves?
Yeah, well, look, so when I started, I finished my traineeship would have been in 91.
Okay.
So I was out there in 92. Some of the good players you had, Robert Allenby's and Stuart Appleby's, who those guys are about the same age as me.
Okay. And real trailblazers. Appleby in particular going straight to America and bypassing. It was a real change in time, wasn't it, for professionals?
Yes. And back then we had two halves to the season. There was no tour school, or we started the tour school in about 92, 93. Okay. And when I started, if you made the cut in the previous tournament, you automatically got to start the following week. So that was interesting. And look, really, it was like a travelling roadshow, I suppose. So there was always a heap of you.
Run through some of the names of events. There'll be people that are sitting at home nodding, going, "Oh, I remember that. I remember that. I remember that."
Well, you had your Australian Open and your Australian Masters, at Huntingdale, and then we had tournaments in Asia, some tournaments up there. So we had the Malaysian Masters, the PRAC Masters, and we had the Air New Zealand Opens and. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of events.
Ford Open, I think, in South Australia.
Ford Open in 90, South Australia, Australian PGA, Queensland Open. You had your state opens as well.
Yes, as I was going to say, that was a time.
Yeah, so it was a good time. And, I mean, I was only out there really for about 5 years. I finished it at the end of 96. But,
just before Tiger. Good thinking.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, spot on. Spot on. I would never have loved to have been playing when he was playing.
You'd love to watch it as a front row seat, but you don't want to have to go up against that, do you? I'm sure.
Right.
It's funny, I'm reminded, I'm sure Peter Lonard told this story on this very podcast, that time when you could make the cut and get a start the following week. It was an Australian Open, and I think he was in that position where he had to make the cut to make the following week, and he was 12th or 13th hole on the Friday or something. He was close to the cut line. He snipe hooked one, hit a wheelie bin and bounced back out into the fairway, got it up and down for birdie, made the cut. And then it was after that, then he went on to win the Australian Masters and go to play. And that one shot, you could almost say, if it had missed the bin,
yeah,
every chance he's got take two club lengths,
yeah,
add a shot, and he might not have made it. It's just extraordinary how those things can turn in the game. That is, of course, professional golf. Now, I'm partly down here to see an old friend of this podcast, Sandy Jamison, and he told me to ask you specifically about a tournament in Malaysia.
Right, yeah, I gotcha.
So I'd like you to tell that, because it probably, from the little bit he told me, I think it might sum up professional golf as a way to make a living.
Yeah, well, look, it was interesting. So he'd be talking about the Malaysian Masters. It was the third tournament that I'd ever played.
So this is in 92?
This is in 92. So in 91, I finished my traineeship in 91. But at the in the middle of 91, I actually made the cut in the New South Wales Open,
mm-hmm,
which then got me into the next tournament, which was a tournament in Malaysia.
Right, okay.
Yes. So went over there and missed the cut at a place called Ipoh, and then had to go and pre-qualify for the Malaysian Masters, which was in KL the following week. So went down there and actually qualified. So pre-qualified for the event, and was my third ever tournament, and I was going to be on the road for about 6 weeks thereabouts.
Were you young enough at this point to still think you were going to be the next world number one?
Well, I was.
Was 3 weeks in enough to know that this was harder than it looked?
I was 22 at the time.
Okay.
So anyway, effectively, was near the lead after round one, in the lead after round two, and led after round three, and
how hard could it
be? And I thought, you know, this is pretty easy, this game. And then got to the 17th hole, tied for the lead, and I was playing with Brad Hughes and Terry Price.
Oh, a couple of flushes there.
Yeah, a couple of flushes, a couple of really good players, a couple of great guys too.
Yeah, very much.
And Terry Price birdied 17 to go one in front of both Brad and myself, and we stood on the last tee at Royal Selangor Golf Club. There was a water carry of about 120 metres, and Terry just bust one straight down the middle of the fairway, and I got up there and I actually cold topped it.
Really?
Brad Hughes then got up and he sniped one into the trees on the left. I think he was that shattered with what I did. He sort of went out in sympathy, and then I thought that they would have to bring the practice ball bag out so that I could actually I didn't think there was enough golf balls. Anyway, I got it over the water the second time and ended up running outright fifth. But funny story with that, I was sort of being grilled after it by a couple of sections of the media. What happened? And Terry Price came to my aid, and he actually said that his hands were really sweaty. It was hot. It was really muggy, and his hands slipped off the club at the top of the swing. So Terry came to my aid, which was very nice of him.
It was very nice of him. Is that what happened?
That's not what,
what happened.
So
talk
anyway.
Me through that. What is that about? Evan, I would imagine by that time it's probably been close to double-digit years since you've topped the golf ball.
Yeah, yeah. So it has happened. It did happen a couple of times when I was playing. Where
pressure?
You just hit. No, I don't know. You just hit a rank shot.
Just the wrong time.
Hit. And like with that one, absolutely. It was, and then for a period of time after that, when I stood on a tee that had water in front, it used to go through my mind. Wow. I'd stand there and I'd think, geez, you know, it's there's water in front there.
That's powerful, isn't it? Because there's clearly no reason for you to give any thought to a water carry of 120 metres.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless they've asked you to hit a 60-degree wedge, in which case you might have to really jump on
That's right. That's right. So that's what happened.
What do you think that's about? I think this is probably what in some ways appeals to people about golf. It does things to you that you can't understand, doesn't it? There's no explanation for what happened to you there.
No. And look, you even see it today where you see world-class golfers hitting pretty ordinary shots at times.
In fact, it's one of the great reasons to go live to the golf. They never show you that on television, or rarely.
Yeah.
When you go out and watch golf, I'm always fascinated by the number of bad shots really good golfers hit. They then, of course, recover because they're extraordinary players.
That's right,
But you see way more bad shots than you'd expect. There's a real joy in that as a recreational player. See a top-level touring pro hit a bad shot. It's like a car accident at the races, isn't it? It's like you kind of come for a little bit of it, don't you?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker. At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf lowest price guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Yeah, oh, sorry, I interrupted you. So your thoughts on what that's about, perhaps? Having played at the top level, that's as much pressure as you can feel on a golf course. And I accept that the guy trying to win the C grade club championship is feeling the absolutely same sort of pressure as what you're feeling there. But that's, do you have any explanation for what that's about? There's a, the human mind does a weird thing, doesn't it, about consequences?
Look, I don't know. I can't put a finger on it. It was just one of those things, and that's what it was. Yeah. So, you know, you wind up making triple bogey and
you said it stayed with you.
Yeah, well, it did. It did. I remember the following week we were playing up in Singapore Island. I had another really good finish, and there was a couple of holes there that had a bit of a water carry, and I stood on the tee, and I was thinking about it. I think, God, you know.
How many did you have to hit over before you finally rid yourself of that?
Well, I don't know.
You don't panic these days, I'd imagine. You
don't go to the panic. No, I don't really know, but it did. It sort of sat with me for a bit, yeah.
What are those emotions of it? It feels like at recreational players, I think we feel embarrassment and humiliation and shame when we hit really terrible shots. Is it the same for a pro, or is it more about the pragmatic effect of what that's going to have on your score, which is what you're playing for?
Yeah, well, at the time, there was certainly devastation. But then, you know, for me, when I look back and I thought, you know, it was a third tournament of my career, and I had a big chance to win a big tournament, and I actually had to pre-queue for the tournament. Mm. So I had to go through the Monday. So I was, if somebody had said to me prior to going over there that this is what was going to happen, I would have said, you're crazy. I'm probably, you know, I'd be happy to make the cut. That's where I sort of saw myself.
And, of course, professional golf is, if someone had said to you you were going to finish fifth, you go, that's an amazing result for a third event. But, of course, the way you finish fifth changes the perspective on all of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
You've got to be able to sort of look at it coldly. What might have been different had that not happened? Let's say you'd strike one 10 yards past Terry Price, stuck it to a foot, made the birdie, he made a bogey, and you'd won. What would have happened then for Evan Tripp, do you reckon? Impossible to say, obviously. But
absolutely impossible to say. But, look, I don't know, for me in my career, well, you know, I love playing golf.
Competitively or just playing golf?
No, competitively. I love that. But I didn't like the lifestyle.
Right.
I didn't like the travel. Okay. I don't like airports. Hotel rooms, I don't like. I'd much rather be home. And there was always the pull of here. So would things have changed? I don't know. When I stopped, it was when my wife was pregnant with our first son and just about to give birth, and that was when I finished up in 96.
Time to grow up, Evan.
And I thought to myself,
get a proper job.
exactly. And, you know, having this place on my doorstep, certainly there was a pull from here.
Is everyone who's good cut out for competitive golf? I think you just answered that question, but I don't think we ever talk about it, do we?
No, I don't think so. You get a lot of great players, but, you know, you've got to have that competitive spirit, or you've got to be a competitor, I think, number one. Mm. You can have a great golf swing and you can be a pretty good player, but if you haven't got that, you know, intestinal fortitude, you know, it's difficult.
It's not a killer instinct, is it, in golf? It's not that direct. You're not sort of trying to beat anyone, but you've got to have the killer instinct to beat the course, your previous play, whatever it might be. It's a different kind of thing, isn't it? It's not as direct as other
sports. Yeah, that's right. And you do. You see some people, they thrive in the heat of the challenge, you know, when it's close. And I just look at it right now. I see Dave Micheluzzi, who's a very good friend of Fraser's, and they played their golf together. Well, Dave, in the last year or so,
he's grown to love it.
You give him a sniff, and he's, you know, you open the door a little bit and he's through it.
Peter Senior and Craig Parry really spring to mind in that, don't they?
Yes,
I asked Peter
exactly
Senior
right.
about that. And he said, I don't know.
Yeah.
He said, I don't know why. He said, but when I get near the lead, everything gets better.
Yeah, and that's right. And I've seen Pete do that. Mm. Absolutely.
He's an extraordinary golfer.
Amazing golfer.
To beat that field at the 2015 Australian Masters was off the charts as an achievement. Probably one of Australia's most underrated sporting achievements, I think, in that sense. You, like most people who've been around the game for a long time, particularly as a good player, must know a bunch of this, and this speaks to what we were just talking about, a bunch of guys who you've never seen people play the game so well, who've never made it for whatever reason.
Look, it's hard to win. I think it's just so hard to win. And you've got to have, you know, the cards have got to fall your way a bit. You've got to have a little bit of luck here or there. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's been a lot of good golfers that have never won.
Mm.
And you know, for what reason?
Better often than some of the guys who do win.
Correct. Yes.
Physically. I remember Nathan Greene won on the US Tour. And no disrespect, Nathan Greene was a fabulous golfer.
Absolutely.
But you could go out and follow Nathan Greene at a golf course and never think to yourself, this guy's a world beater. Yet, I think he beat in, I think he won in a playoff with Jose Maria Olazabal and somebody else, if I'm not mistaken.
That was in Canada.
Canada, yeah. Is that Stones? Is that what we call it? Stones? Is that what some people talk about? That ability?
He was tough. He was a tough guy. Mm. Yeah.
And in some ways, perhaps not being as physically gifted as some of the others works to your advantage because you just put your head down and work that bit harder and you're going to show them anyway, maybe?
Maybe, yeah. Absolutely, I'd agree with that.
I heard somebody talking about boxing, coaching boxers, and he said there's two types of boxers. There's really talented boxers, and they're lazy because they're good, and there's not very talented boxers who are really hard workers, and sometimes the hard workers, you've got to tell them to slow down a bit because they work too hard, and sometimes the lazy ones, you need to teach them how to work. But I think golf, that probably sums up golf too, doesn't it? Some people pick up a club. Stuart Appleby picked up a club the first time, made par on the first hole he ever played. Mm. That's infuriating and sickening to somebody like me,
yes,
who's been at it for 30 years and still struggles to make a par. But does that make sense to you? You would have, well, I imagine you've been involved in Fraser's career too as a good player, and you would have coached various players. Does that analogy make sense to you? Are there two types of sort of people, or is there a third or a fourth that we're missing?
Yeah, look,
out on
there? No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think that certainly you get players that are super talented and they find it very, very easy.
You work hard?
Yeah, exactly. And they can always smack the ball and they always shoot good scores at a maybe the club level, but then you get the kid or the player that maybe not quite as talented and they work hard, they work their backsides off and then they go on and on and on and they just keep striving to get to another level. They keep trying to push and push and push. So they go out of the club and they go to the regional events, you know, around their home club, and then they go on to state events and they just keep improving and improving and improving.
Mm. And, of course, when you get the two together, that's when you get Tiger.
Correct.
The extraordinary gift and the extraordinary work ethic. Because Tiger's always said that John Daly is the most gifted golfer he ever saw, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he and did. He's lazy. Did, but
he's in the lazy camp.
Yeah, but Stuart Appleby said to me that is Tiger the most talented person you've ever seen? And I said, yes. And he said, so if he works harder than anyone else and he's the most talented, what hope have we got?
That's right.
And that's, I think that's Stuart's sort of take on Tiger.
I think
he thought he worked harder and he was super talented.
Yeah. Vijay Singh's an extraordinarily hard
Correct.
Worker. Talented player, but not in the league of the very, but became the world number one by working super hard. Stuart Appleby always had great quotes about Tiger. I think it was after the third round of a PGA one year, and Tiger was about four or five in front. I think Appleby might have been the Masters, actually, in 07.
Right.
And he said, what do you think, what are you going to have to shoot tomorrow to win? He said, Tiger. It's the most obvious answer, but it makes sense. What was that like growing up in that sort of era and running with those guys?
Well, I didn't really run with those guys. I turned trainee and they were super amateurs.
Right.
So I sort of came along and I knew Stuart because he's from Kahuna, which is just down the river. But Stuart, he was a great amateur and he forged his path through that and then he turned pro at about the same time. But I did a 3-year traineeship.
Right.
So we didn't really cross paths that much. Until we then got out on tour. But Stuart was certainly at a different level to where I was, although I had a couple of good results.
Well, there's a million ways to get it done, isn't there?
Yes, true.
You know, it's entertainment, so the most spectacular way is the way that's the best rewarded, generally. It doesn't mean it's the only way.
That's right.
I heard Greg Norman say once many years ago that the difference between the 20 marker and the scratch marker is smaller than the difference between the scratch marker and the touring professional. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
How good do you have to be to play, to think about playing the game for a living?
Oh.
And do golf fans understand?
I'm not sure that they do, that they do understand. Look, I know some people even around this area now that play off plus five, plus six, and they're not playing on the tour. It's a massive jump, and things have got to go right.
Can you put your finger on it? Plus five, plus six, you've clearly got the tools. You should be able to think about it. Doesn't mean you'll make it, but can you put your finger on maybe what that difference is?
I think getting out of their comfort zone and being able to do it in an event. So a lot of people can shoot a great number.
At their home course.
At their home course. Get them away from their home course with some players that are just as good, and it's not quite as easy anymore.
And then all the other stuff comes into it, doesn't it?
Correct.
Being able to embrace the lifestyle and enjoy that and put up with the pressures. The pressures are enormous, aren't they? You've got financial pressure at the start. Then if you make it, you've got less financial pressure, more media pressure, more public scrutiny. Can you imagine your golf game being as scrutinised as Rory McIlroy's? I mean, that's a it's like an interrogation, isn't it, on a daily basis.
Yeah, he
must read things about his own golf game that just make him roll his eyes at times. Who are these people? Yeah, and everyone feels free to take a shot, don't they?
Yeah. But look, at the end of the day, it's, you know, I suppose the more successful you become, it's, you know, the more pressure. Yeah, exactly.
The more you're able to deal with it, that's how you get there.
That's right.
That's kind of the difference. Professional golf, tournament golf plays a role, obviously, in the game. How important is that role? You're a club professional here at a very successful and busy club. How important is the professional game out there to that? And do you see any – we've talked a bit on other podcasts that I do about some of the issues with the Live PGA Tour thing to the non-golf community paints the game in a way that you and I don't see it. But then when it comes to wanting to close Oakley Golf Course or half of Moore Park Golf Course in Sydney public facilities – those things play a role because non-golfers are like, yeah, well, there was those rich people. Do you see anything of that? What's your take on that, the role of professional golf in what is essentially your business?
Yeah, well, I think so if we're talking about professional golf tournaments and professional golfers or golfers that play professionally, I think that at the end of the day, if we have big tournaments in Australia and people watch it on TV or maybe go to the tournament, then – you know, people get a bit of a buzz out of that, and then they come back and kids try to emulate that person. So, you know, we get a bit of a spike.
The Greg Norman effect, you might call it.
Yeah, effectively. So when Norman was flying, golf was booming.
Good time too, though, the 80s.
Yeah, correct. You
know, anything that felt affluent and decadent and golf fits that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's how even golfers, I think, perceive golf a little bit that way.
Yes.
As an elitist kind of a pursuit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when the big tournaments are on, you certainly see it. I mean, people watch it and they talk about it and, you know, it becomes a topic of, you know, conversation in the pro shop and out on the putting green and – they talk about what they've seen.
That's among golfers. What do you think it does among non-golfers? Because more and more we're starting to bump up against this, probably not so much in a place like Yarrawonga, but in Sydney and Melbourne where the pressures of cities are really closing in on those public facilities, the little Oakley golf course where Sandy spent so much time and launched his one club. They're talking about repurposing that for something else, you know. Is golf the best use for it? Non-golfers become pretty important to the conversation then, don't they? And we need to think about how we present to them.
Yes, absolutely. We do need to do that. We need to, because at the end of the day, we're trying to get those people that are, you know, current non-golfers into the game in a perfect world. So look at, it's extremely important that we work hard to try and get non-golfers into it. Mm. And that's what Sandy Jamieson does do.
Sandy's been on this podcast, and I think he's, what he's developed is kind of the answer in so many
ways. Yeah, so much of his life is based around this type of thing. Trying to get, and he works here 3 days a week, you know, Wednesday, Thursdays, Fridays, and a lot of it is now we're going to be trying to bring new golfers, so people that currently don't play golf or may have played once or twice, try to get them into the game here at this club.
I'll be curious to see if you've seen it. I have. Sandy always says he takes non-golfers and turns them into golfers within about 15 minutes, and I didn't believe him when he first told me. I've seen it in action. I know that it's actually true. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it. Well? I've seen what he does, and I think he does a great job of it.
Yeah.
But it's
– is it a cure-all?
Pardon?
If, Is it a cure-all? If we instituted one club golf in every golf club across Australia tomorrow, would that solve golf's problems? Would we then be have too many people wanting to play golf, do you reckon? Or is it?
Well, it'd be a great problem to have, wouldn't it?
It really would be
a great problem to have. But
for you, not for me if I'm having tea times. Great right. for you if you're selling them, that's not right. if I'm buying them.
But you know, the more golfers we have, that you know, the better off everyone will be. You know, in the golf network.
Yeah. Is that just a business thing, or do you think golf is a good influence in people's lives beyond that?
No, I think it's not just a business thing. I think golf is great for, you know, everything. You know, your social well-being, your fitness, the whole lot. And then if they come to a place like this and they're out there, then they go in and have a drink and a bite to eat afterwards, the club does well, they're happy, you know, everyone does well.
Yeah.
You know, and the health is
One time, but you're the first golf pro I've come across since I had this thought a couple of weeks ago, so I'm going to ask you about this.
Right.
I intend to ask lots of golf pros about it. You've given a million lessons and played a million rounds of golf, so you'll probably get one. We talk about the importance of golf and health for particularly older people, and we think about that as the walking and the swinging, and that's true. All of that plays a role. What about the mental aspects of golf itself, the mathematics, the judgment, the constant weighing up of circumstances and having to pick between hitting this club and that club? We don't talk about it, do we? But particularly for older people, that mental exercise might be at least as important as the walk, might it not? Or am I overplaying that?
No, I think really you're right. At the end of the day, what I'll see, you know, if they're sitting at home and not thinking about much, by getting them out here in the fresh air, and you're right. And, you know,
make a decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Got to think about what they're
that's
doing.
Right.
And then they've got to, you know, they've got to add the scorecard up too.
That's true. And not everybody's great at that, as you would know. And of course, once you've had to make the decision, then you've got to deal with the emotions of having made the wrong decision.
Yeah.
Or whatever it might be, the joys that come with the game and the roller coaster. All of that stuff, I think, is probably more important than we pay attention to. And it might be one of the missing pieces in what we need to tell non-golfers.
Yes, certainly.
In that,
yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, it's not just a bunch of rich people in bad clothes walking around. There's enough of that, and none of us in golf are particularly keen on that either. But here's why golf actually does improve people's lives and work, and this is one of the aspects of it that, which is an argument against rangefinders, I guess, isn't it? You probably sell rangefinders, so you won't
enjoy
me saying that. So
that's right.
Yeah, indeed. What does the future hold, do you reckon, Evan? You've been around the game for a long time, so you've got a lot of understanding of how it's where it's come from. What do you reckon the future holds for golf?
For golf?
I feel like you're pretty good here. That everything works well for this. This is a big operation. 45 holes, two 18-hole courses and a 9-hole executive course. That's a huge – I don't need to tell you what a huge operation that is. But for the game generally, I mean, do you feel secure here? Because having said that, of course, when you've got a big operation, it doesn't take much for things to turn the other way either, does it? You kind of got to keep this place pretty full.
Yeah, we do.
To
we
keep
do.
It ticking
so,
over.
Yeah, no,
it's
we
a
do.
Pressure.
It's a well. This place has got a lot of visiting clientele, so we have a lot of visitors, and it's very much a retirement area. So we have a lot of people retire. So our population is growing. So for a place like this, I think the future and along the river, I think it's pretty bright.
Broadly. Given some of those issues we just talked about, you knew you would follow it, I'm sure.
Yeah, broadly.
Issues at Moore Park and Oakley.
Yeah, broadly, I think that at the end of the day, we've got to get people, you know, keep people interested and keep people playing for longer if they can, and then try and really, you know, hit it at grassroots level and try to get the young kids in.
It's the important part of the game. Yeah. So I was walking in here, Evan, I saw people in T-shirts, Evan, at a golf course. This is an unthinkable scenario. What are you doing?
So we open it up to – we want to make it accessible, and we want people to come. So we can't afford to have it, so it's difficult for people to come and play golf.
That's a business decision?
Absolutely.
Simple business decision.
So at the end of the day, you want people to enjoy themselves. We have a bowling green that sits out the front, or we have two, and people can play barefoot bowls. So that's acceptable. Why can't they have a putt in bare feet or with a pair of thongs on?
Have you always thought that? You didn't really think much about it in the past, did we?
No,
it was just,
no
this
probably
is how
we've
golf
certainly
was.
No, we've certainly changed, and certainly here we've changed the ways in which we do think. And look, I really believe we want to make it accessible. We want to give people a reason why they want to play, rather than a million reasons why they can't. you know, it's,
we've done that, haven't we?
Absolutely.
We did that. It worked for us for a while, but it kind of stopped working around 2000. I'm always reminded to go back to Sandy, and I think he makes the point so well. He said, imagine standing outside the Chadstone Shopping Centre in Melbourne, which is one of the biggest shopping centres in the world, and telling people, certain people, I say, oh, you can't go in dressed like that.
Well, it wouldn't work, would it?
That's what we do in golf, though, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You can't go in dressed like that. Yeah. Oh, you're wearing black socks. This is unacceptable. Well, really stupid stuff.
Yeah, but that's changed, hasn't it?
It's changing. I wonder what's been the impact here. You can't make an omelette without breaking a couple of eggs. Not everybody would be on board or happy with the notion of people walking around here in T-shirts, I'm sure. And I'm sure that they're more than comfortable pointing out to you that they're not happy about that situation.
Yes, well, it doesn't happen as much now. But no. There certainly always had been a stigma attached to golf being maybe that elitist type game. But it is definitely changing now, and we don't get too many comments now. That's all pretty good.
Is it one of those things, Evan, which seems like a big deal at the time, but after the change? I heard Mike Clayton talk about this the other day on a podcast, you know, smoking in pubs. It's going to ruin the industry. Pubs will shut down all over Australia. You won't be able to go to a pub and have a drink because you can't smoke in the pub. And then, of course, like 6 months later, nothing's really changed. Is this one of those things, do you think, for golf? Is
absolutely.
That golf's moment of that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. So the easier we make it, the more people we get into the place, and, you know, the better the club does.
Let me guess, you sell T-shirts in the pro shop?
Absolutely.
No, I do. But do you? You sell T-shirts in
the odd T-shirt. Golf T-shirt.
That's fantastic. How long are you going to be here for? Is Fraser or Baxter going to take over? How long will the Droop dynasty be? You know, I imagine there's not a golfer from this area who has not played with, against, or on a team with a Droop at some point.
That's a good question. So I'm 53 now.
You don't look a day over 52, I'll be honest with you. You really don't.
So I'm 53. So Fraser is currently living his best life up on the Gold Coast. Very, very happy up there. He's 27. Baxter's 20. And in his last year of his traineeship, look, I can see myself being here for, I don't know, a year or two.
A while.
A little bit more.
Do you think either of the boys will be interested in taking over? You can't force them to.
Yeah, no. Them. Well, yeah, look, I think so. I think, in the future, who knows? Who knows? But they're both keen, to be in the industry in some way, shape or form.
Born here, both of them in Yarrawonga?
Both of them born here, so both locals just like me.
Something different about being born in the country, I feel like, do you think? I don't mean that in a bad way.
No, absolutely.
I feel like there's something to do. People absolutely. Are born in cities. Cities are kind of cities almost wherever they are, but country towns are different. They've got an identity maybe.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's all right. That's spot on. And, you know, they were both born here. My kids were born here. And I think that if you're from the country, you're always proud to say where you've come from.
Yeah. Would you like one of them to be interested in taking over? Or are you not fussed either way? Not to put any pressure on. They won't listen anyway because it's dad. That's boring.
If the cards fell that way, I think that it would be, a great thing. It'd be great for the club, and I think it'd be great for our family. And it would just, it'd just keep that dynasty rolling along.
Mm. Something I wanted to ask about, and I'll finish up with this because I was reading, I did some Googling on you. That's what I call research. Did some Googling about Evan Droop and found various things. And one of the things I found was a piece about a program running at a golf course that might have even been on the Gold Coast by a former trainee of yours. Dawned on me that it's one thing we probably don't pay enough attention to. Lots of people will go through your professional golfing life, won't they? And they go off into the world and they take the things that you've taught them to those new places and whatnot. Talk a little bit about that and how that kind of makes you. You must have trainees have come through here who have ended up in very important positions overseas, some of them probably even. And you've sort of played your part in that. It's a funny kind of big family, the PGA, isn't it, in a weird way?
Yeah, look, it is. And I've had trainees right through. The good thing is that they could sort of play a bit. Adam Burdett. It was a young fella that won the West Australian Trainee Championship, and he came through here. Fraser won just about everything there was to win as a trainee. I've got a young fella, Dale Crothers, who's just finishing his time, but he's won the Victorian Trainee Championships a couple of times. So, we've had a few trainees come through here and they do what they do. But most importantly, we want to be decent people and decent PGA members.
I probably think less about some of those playing achievements and more about some of those achievements who guys who've gone on to do what you're doing but elsewhere. and they take the lessons they've learned here, add it into all the other lessons they've learned. But you've played a part then in how the culture's unfolding at another club, haven't you?
Yeah, I suppose you do. So we've got Craig Stickling from South Africa, who's now the...
That's who I was thinking.
Yeah, so he's now the Director of Golf at New South Wales, La Perouse.
There you go.
Yeah, so he was here not so long ago.
It's a long way from Yarrawonga to New South Wales in some ways, isn't it?
Well, it is, but previously from there is South Africa.
Hmm.
So he came from South Africa to be with us, and now he's at New South Wales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it just must be a funny little thing to see what people go on to do.
That, absolutely. You know,
a little bit of influence in their career. And then
we gave him a start in Australia, Craig.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Evan, it's been lovely to chat to you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on what you've on yourself and your dad and however many generations of droops might be running the Yarrawonga and Border Yarrawonga Mulwala Golf Club Resort. Been terrific to talk to you today. Thanks very much. Really appreciate
it. Thanks, Rod. Anytime.
I think Evan is what we might call a lifer, not only following in his dad's footsteps, but leading his sons on the same journey. Big thanks again to Evan and the Yarrawonga and Border Club for the access and the time. As always, we switch gears for our next episode when John Huggan catches up with one of the game's most colourful characters.
I don't have to share the ball. It's my ball. You can go away. You're not coming anywhere near my ball. It's mine and I'm hitting it.
That's Wayne Radar Riley, next time on The Thing About Golf.